I next met with Dr. Steve Horwitz for an update on the complex world of T-cell lymphomas, and to begin, Dr. Horwitz provided an overview of the field.
Some of the basics are just really understanding what diseases we're talking about and going over a little bit the terms. I find if you can get past that, you know, you're at least halfway or more there, because the different treatments we have, you know, we're sort of early in developing new therapies. So the treatments are pretty simple, straightforward once you know what you're talking about and what the prognosis is. So I'd start by saying, you know, we have this very confusing term called peripheral T-cell lymphoma, which describes really almost all of the T-cell lymphomas that medical oncologists will see. And the term peripheral T-cell lymphoma refers to a mature or post-thymic T-cell lymphoma, differentiating it not from skin, which is very confusing, but from ALL or lymphoblastic or early T-cell lymphoma. So that's sort of the definition, is those mature T-cell lymphomas. And then you can roughly divide those into what are relatively more aggressive diseases that we treat, similar to we treat large B-cell lymphoma. The most common of that subtype is something unfortunately named peripheral T-cell lymphoma not otherwise specified. So it has the same name in the WHO classification of the whole broader category of diseases, and it just doesn't fit into any of the other compartments. And then within those aggressive sort of systemic T-cell lymphomas that we tend to treat aggressively, you have things called angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, anaplastic large cell lymphoma, which we can talk a little bit about because that's sort of its own confusing nomenclature, and then some of the other types like the enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphomas, and then you get into these rare subtypes, nasal NKT, hepatosplenic, etc.
How about HTLV-related?
HTLV-related would fit in the aggressive T-cell lymphoma category for the most part under that same big, broad category of peripheral T-cell lymphomas. I separate those out a little bit because in the sort of aggressive T-cell lymphomas, PTCL, NOS, the sort of bad anaplastic large cell lymphomas, and the angioimmunoblastics, it's probably okay to take a large B-cell lymphoma approach, meaning CHOP, maybe autotransplant, something aggressive combination. We know that for the HTLV-1-associated lymphomas, and again, you know, you're always subdividing here, there's the aggressive groups, which are called acute or leukemic and lymphomatous. So basically, people who have disease that you can see progressing at a reasonable pace. Those patients will respond often to those chemotherapies, but really never durably. So that same high-dose chemotherapy, combination CHOP, auto transplant, probably never, almost never works for those patients. So I kind of think those patients, I mean, I don't really know what the best way to treat is, but we think about things like allotransplant upfront in a young patient, or we think about maintenance type therapies, although we don't have much data there. But they would fit broadly under that category. I think their treatment strategy is a little different. I kind of have this very simplistic slide that sometimes when I lecture, where if you say CHOP is the most standard treatment for aggressive T-cell lymphomas, you can divide a patient into always, sometimes, and never. So there's this one group of subset of anaplastic large cell lymphoma patients that express a protein called ALK1. So that's a nodal systemic T-cell lymphoma, CD30 positive, anaplastic large cell, but expresses this protein called ALK1, which I think people will know more about now because there's some lung cancer drugs targeted at that. So I think that's more on people's radar. That group of patients, probably 70% or so of the time, are cured with CHOP. So it's probably the right thing to do for those people. You take the PTCL, not otherwise specified, the angioimmunoblastic, the ALK-negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma. Those patients are cured probably between 15 and 25% of the time with CHOP. So I put them in a sometimes category. We don't know that anything's clearly better, but the results are not good, but there's a chance they're cured. And then you have this group of diseases where CHOP is probably never adequate therapy. The HTLV-1s are never cured with CHOP. The nasal NK, maybe CHOP chemotherapy, but radiation's an important part of that. Hepatosplenics are never cured with CHOP. And then there you have all the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, which most of them don't need combination chemotherapy. So for that group, CHOP's probably too much therapy. It's easier to show visually, but if you kind of think about them in those three buckets, you know, probably cured with CHOP, ALK positive, maybe, but probably not, most of the more common aggressive T-cell lymphomas, and then a long list of rare diseases where CHOP's probably not the right thing to do. Just to clarify, where I see a lot of people get tripped up is in the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. Because a lot of the aggressive peripheral T-cell lymphomas will have skin lesions, and sometimes they'll have only skin lesions. And those, when people talk about cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, tend not to be the diseases they're talking about. those can still be aggressive diseases in the skin. And when we say CTCL or cutaneous, you really mean mycosis fungoides or some of the CD30 positive cutaneous lymphomas. And the aggressive T-cell lymphoma in the skin, I think, is an area where there's a lot of confusion on the part of pathologists if they don't have the clinical background and on the clinicians who are seeing the patients.
So how about treatment?
So in terms of treatment, you know, I think we've been stuck with this B-cell approach, and that's just because those patients, I think, were always lumped in historically with using CHOP. So upfront treatment for the aggressive lymphomas, it's still mostly combination chemotherapy with kind of the results that I said, 15 to 25% long-term remission for the common subtypes. There's been a lot of data looking at escalating that with auto transplant. A lot of that's retrospective and it's a little confusing. You know, we have now kind of two-ish prospective studies, good-sized prospective studies out of Europe, which show that if you respond to chemotherapy, half of patients will be alive for 3 years, progression-free survival in sort of the 33 to 50% range long-term. So my view is that may be better than CHOP. I think if you have a healthy patient who is low risk of an auto transplant, I think it's a perfectly reasonable approach to do because I think that may be better than we get with CHOP alone, but by no means is that sort of established in any randomized fashion. You know, we always struggle with this idea that when we're transplanting patients, are we just selecting for the better patients anyway in terms of performance, status, tolerance, and really maybe not changing their outcome with therapy? You know, if you're really trying to look at what you get with standard therapy, I think there's a nice study from Germany where Reimer from the JCO a year ago is the first author, and they gave patients CHOP with the idea of doing an auto transplant. And I think that's a nice view of what we get with CHOP in a prospective fashion. So they had almost an 80% response rate, about 39, 40% were complete responses. But if you look at what happened by intent to treat, about 2/3 of patients went to transplant. But if you take their initial 80-so patients at the beginning, only about 1/3 are long-term in remission. And then you get a pretty good split based on the patients who went to transplant are doing well 50 to 70% of the time 3 years later. And the patients who didn't go to transplant obviously, you know, didn't respond and did much poorly. So I think that's kind of a reasonable approach of what kind of numbers we really get with our conventional approaches. There's been a lot of stuff looked at trying to add things to CHOP. There's a nice study that Francine Foss led adding Denileukin diftitox to CHOP. Again, it gets hard to interpret because these are not large single-arm studies. She had a very high response rate with, I think it was 70-plus percent of patients having a complete response, so maybe better than what we get with CHOP alone. But almost 40% of the patients in that study didn't get through the whole course of treatment, which I think really limited the utility of the results. So I think, you know, the question with that is maybe it's better, is the Denileukin diftitox plus the CHOP making it very hard to take, or were they just really sick patients? Very similar data with adding alemtuzumab to CHOP, so the anti-CD52 antibody. It looks like you may increase the response rate. You still get relapses, maybe better than CHOP, you know, but the data, there's an Italian study from Gallimini, you know, 20-some patients with 2 years of follow-up. Half the patients are alive in remission at 2 years. So again, maybe better than CHOP. Alemtuzumab does add a lot of toxicity in terms of infectious complications. There were some infectious deaths on that study. So I think those are reasonable research questions. Probably, you know, my view is when you look at the phase two data, it's not so clearly better that it would probably take a randomized study to do that, to really sort out whether that's a better strategy. And one of the things that we think about in a rare disease is, do we have enough patients to really do a randomized study? There's really never been one done. And do we yet have a strategy that you'd be ready to commit what would really have to be an international effort on this one strategy? And I think so far, adding the single drugs to CHOP don't look great in terms of that. A lot of, you know, when you think about research, which I think people can sort of apply to practice, is if we can get regimens that have very high complete response rates building onto CHOP or onto different chemotherapy backbones, then maybe you could take those forward in a randomized fashion. I think as long as we're in this 50, 70% response rate, it's hard to imagine that that's going to be way better than what we get with standard therapy alone, because if most of your patients or a significant portion are not getting into complete response, it's hard to imagine that those people would stay long-term in remission. And again, if we're going to do a randomized study, we need a strategy to look at overall survival or progression-free survival benefit.
What about Denileukin and alemtuzumab? And there have been a lot of other agents utilizing this disease in the recurrent setting or progressive disease setting.
Yeah, most of the data until recently, you know, until we started getting some registration or some drugs looking for FDA approval, the studies have been kind of small, often single institution. But there's a nice study from Nam Dang and MD Anderson with over a 40% response rate with Denileukin Diftitox. I don't think others of us have seen that clinically, but that's not on a study. So I think that's a reasonable agent in the relapse setting. And that, you know, having 20 to 30 patients in a phase two study like that is actually, at least till recently, quite a big study for T-cell lymphoma. There's a lot of small studies with gemcitabine. There's clearly some activity there. Whether it's 20% or 50%, I think it's hard to tell. You get a very small experience. I can say clinically that we do see activity of that drug. I've not seen a lot of really durable responses where you can maintain the remission on that therapy, but I think there's activity there. Liposomal doxorubicin has activity. Alemtuzumab definitely has some activity. In some of the early studies, you know, again, T-cell lymphoma, 10, 15 patient studies, there were definite responses. Better for patients with more blood-borne disease, less with really large nodes. Infectious toxicity when you give that drug, particularly in the second and third line setting. There's been a couple of nice experiences in Sézary and cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which I borrow from sometimes with alemtuzumab, where they gave very low doses. So a full dose of alemtuzumab would be 30 milligrams three times a week for maybe 12 weeks. That would be like a full CLL course. And they would give like 10 milligrams for four doses or six doses and just treat until the Sézary level came down to a low level. And then watch the patients, and then as that crept back up, treat again. And it looks like, at least in that more indolent lymphoma, you can get good responses that way, and you get a lot less infectious toxicity. There's a European study, and there's a Northwestern experience using that approach. So often, if I'm using it in the relapse setting in a palliative fashion, I'll kind of borrow that approach. I mean, start low, go a little bit slow, see what response you get, and then titrate the dose there. And we seem to get less infections that way.
So what about the newer agents, pralatrexate and romidepsin?
We're obviously very involved in some of these newer agents. A lot of, by way of personal involvement, is, you know, involved in these studies and developing these drugs. So I have some biases in that direction. I would say at a minimum, the quality of the data that we're generating is much better. So the pralatrexate study, the PROPEL study, which led to approval, is 115 patients, 109 patients. So you can't really find a single agent in the relapse setting with more than 25 or 27 patients outside of these studies. So I think the confidence in the data is quite good. In our Memorial Sloan Kettering experience, when that was first done, when Owen O'Connor was at Memorial and then continued on multi-center after he moved initially to Columbia, we had a very high response rate early on in patients with T-cell lymphoma. And our overall response rate ended up being around 40% or so in those patients. You know, you take that to a 30-plus center study worldwide, the response rate by sort of a formal center review, 27, 29%. Some of those are complete responses. Median duration of response of 10 months. I think that's probably a pretty accurate view of what that drug does. My guess is if you really applied rigorous study criteria to some of these other drugs that we use, gemcitabine, Denileukin Diftitox, alemtuzumab, I don't think we get that clinically, but you're a little bit comparing apples and oranges when you look at 12 or 15 patients treated at a single center versus this.
What about method of administration, side effects, and toxicity?
So pralatrexate, it's pretty easy to administer. It's an IV push, so 3 to 5 minute push. Doesn't cause a lot of nausea. Some patients will get sort of Compazine pre-medication. And the approved schedule is weekly, 6 out of 7 weeks. I think when we look at that, particularly in the relapse refractory patients or patients who've had previous transplant, a lot of patients will miss a dose or two. I'll sort of talk about what they missed that for. So I think there's some flexibility in dosing schedule, but the approved dose is 30 milligrams per square meter weekly, 6 weeks in a row, and then a week off. The main side effect that we saw early on was oral stomatitis. So that was in the early studies, that was very severe. That really limited patients staying on drug. If you give vitamin pre-supplementation in the label, folic acid, vitamin B12, kind of optimize homocysteine and methylmalonic acid, we do think we see less of that. So I think that may be important in abrogating some of those side effects. The catch is where we saw the really bad toxicity was also at much higher doses of drug. So at the same time vitamin administration was added, the doses came down and the schedule changed. So a few variables were changed at once. But that's the main side effect the patients feel. The main hematologic side effect is thrombocytopenia. So I think in a 6 week cycle, it's pretty common for patients to miss a dose or two, either due to grade 2 mucositis, you hold it, it'll get better by the next week, or thrombocytopenia, you hold the dose, it'll get better by the next week. And I think particularly in the relapse setting, you're really looking at trying to maintain remission on therapy. So I think if patients are not tolerating, skip a week, usually they'll get back on track and then you can continue on.
Now, is the drug being looked at in earlier stage disease?
There's a lot of thought and planning about trying to move it into the upfront setting. I think one of the difficulties in the T-cell lymphomas is if CHOP had a 0% cure rate, I think we'd all be comfortable giving them pralatrexate or pralatrexate plus another drug in the upfront setting. I think when you're in that 20-ish% cure rate, it's a little hard to select a patient who you're going to give a single agent or a doublet to, because we don't really have experiences in lymphoma where a single drug cures people. You know, it's all probably three and really four and five drug combinations. So we've tried to look at some combinations with gemcitabine. There's some draft protocols that would look at pralatrexate, either integrating it with an upfront chemotherapy regimen, either with initial chemotherapy or alternating, sort of like a hyper-CVAD approach. And then a lot of interest, and I have personal interest in this, in looking at it in a maintenance fashion to see if we can get remissions with CHOP. You know, with CHOP or whatever chemotherapy, we do get a good portion of patients into remission. They often just don't stay in remission. So looking at if we can find tolerable doses and schedules to use as a maintenance. All those are sort of drafted ideas, some written protocols, but nothing that's actually definitely moving forward yet.
Now, how about the HDAC inhibitors and romidepsin?
Romidepsin, just approved for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. We've recently finished it's about 130-patient study for aggressive peripheral T-cell lymphoma, similar design to the pralatrexate study. And that's based on the NCI experience, where they had over a 30%, 35% response rate in those aggressive lymphomas. So we don't have data on that. The central review is going on now, so I don't have response data. But that study's done, so we should have that response data pretty soon. The NCI experience looks pretty good. Again, more than 30% of patients responded across a bunch of different subtypes. There were some durable responses. So patients, again, like the pralatrexate, there aren't really cumulative toxicities. So you can stay on drug kind of as long as it works. We have a woman now who's out 2.5 years on drug with refractory disease. I don't make too much about anecdotes. We'll get real data from a reasonably sized study pretty soon. But I think that class of drug, the HDACs in general, and romidepsin, the most experienced so far, looks like it's active in T-cell lymphomas.
So what about schedule, dose administration, and side effects?
The standard dosing that's approved for CTCL and the same dose and schedule is used for PTCL is 14 milligrams per square meter given IV weekly 3 out of 4 weeks. This is given as a 4-hour infusion, so it's a little longer to give than like the pralatrexate, which is a push. The main issues, historically, there was a lot of worry about QT prolongation, and a couple of early patients, not on the T-cell study, but early in the development of this drug, had some cardiac events. It looks like if you're careful, you know, so we just completed this 130-patient study, if you exclude patients with known arrhythmia, and mostly exclude medications that can also cause QT prolongation, we see almost no changes in QT. So I think if you're careful, that drug can be given safely, and that has been much less of a concern once people have been aware of that risk. In the study of CTCL and peripheral T-cell lymphoma, there was EKG monitoring before and post-treatment. Patients would get their antiemetics, get an EKG checked, make sure the QT wasn't too long before they got administration of drug. Because there was almost no changes in QT, that's not in the label. So some of us have been talking, trying to, you know, adopt how we're using this drug now that it's approved for CTCL off of a study. And what I'm doing, at least, I'm not sure this is the right way, but it's sort of what I've decided seems logical, is check electrolytes at the baseline before the first cycle. Make sure your potassium and magnesium are okay. If they're not, supplement them. I'll check an EKG post-antiemetic with the first cycle and then post-infusion with the first cycle, just the first dose. And if you don't get any QT prolongation, I haven't gone back and then monitored EKGs. But sort of the idea that if there is a patient who's for some reason susceptible, you might catch them with the first dose. And then usually just at the beginning of each cycle, make sure the electrolytes are in line. With the HDACs in general, we saw this with vorinostat, we see it with romidepsin. There's sort of this malaise. It's sometimes nausea and vomiting, but often it's just not feeling well, loss of appetite, food doesn't taste good, it's unappealing. So you get sort of that kind of low-grade not feeling well. That's pretty common. High-grade not feeling well, to where people lose a lot of weight or really have a lot of nausea or vomiting, it's not so common. The main hematologic side effect is thrombocytopenia, so occasionally we'll have to hold drug for low platelet counts. Again, like some of these other drugs, if you skip 1 week, it looks like the thrombocytopenia recovers right away.
So it's kind of hard to get a feel sometime for what these things actually mean from a quality of life point of view, and I don't mean these studies that give you numbers which you can't interpret, but I mean sort of bedside quality of life.
Yeah.
In general, just putting aside stuff that the patient's not going to feel, such as QT right. prolongation, but just sort of how they feel. What fraction of patients on these drugs, or specifically romidepsin, you know, feel fine, and what fraction have some kind of problems?
Yeah. I think like with romidepsin, there's probably 10, 15% who just feel so lousy, it's just not acceptable. They either have a lot of vomiting, they can't work, they spend 4 out of the 7 days in their week in bed. And I think that's a less common group, but there are clearly people who would give drug to. This is no way a long-term solution, because even if it's active, they just don't feel good. I think the others, there's a small group, probably a little bigger than that on the top end, who feel fine, work every day except the day they get their four-hour infusion. I think most people feel tired and loss of appetite, maybe lose a pound or two. Worse for the first few days after the treatment. I have a Monday clinic, so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they have a good weekend, come back and do it again. And in somebody with relapse refractory disease, if it's working, often they'll take that. There's things you can do, you know, just making sure they stay hydrated, kind of changing your foods around to see how you do. And there is a little bit of getting used to it, but there is often a few days where people just don't feel good. And that's pretty common.
And getting back to the pralatrexate, again, from a quality of life point of view, assuming they don't have mucositis or it's been controlled or whatever, do they feel okay?
Generally, they do. There are some patients who we've been doing a CTCL study where some people have been on a long time and we've stopped and restarted. So people generally feel okay. There are a few people who, after they stopped and took a hiatus, in retrospect say, you know, I was really much more tired when I was on that drug. They didn't necessarily notice it at the time. They were kind of doing what they needed to do, but they felt better off of the drug. The main thing with pralatrexate is if you have mouth sores, even if they're low grade, but if that's for 3 or 4 days, I think the people who get the mouth sores, if you can't manage those, it's hard to be on that drug long term because you can't eat well, you're in pain, you're just uncomfortable, and the quality of life is not good. The people without mouth sores, generally, with the exception of a little fatigue, very rare patients have bad nausea, feel okay. And we do have people on that drug now multiple years, more with the cutaneous T-cell lymphoma at some lower doses.
So we'll probably get into this with your cases, but can you give me any kind of general algorithm about how to utilize this whole panoply of drugs, including these two new ones? You know, what comes first, second, and third?
Yeah, the short answer is probably no. I can tell you sort of how I think about it and what I do. I mean, for one, the only approved drug right now of the new ones is pralatrexate. So we can get sort of coverage for some of the older drugs because they're compendia listed. Romidepsin right now is not. So in CTCL, we can use it. In PTCL, it's just on study. My general approach is if you're a person who we think can be cured, meaning you either have low risk factors or you're young and healthy enough that we can somehow escalate the therapy like an auto transplant, we'll try that. If that doesn't work, then I think the question is, what are your goals? So if you're youngish or fairly healthy or have a donor, there is a cure rate with allotransplant. Often what I'll do in the relapse setting is kind of separate patients into people who we know are going to do an allotransplant very soon. They have a sibling who's a match. This is definitely what they want to do. We know we're heading in that direction. And then give a combination chemotherapy to try to get a quick response and just move them on to transplant. I think most of the patients fall into a bucket where we're not sure that's what we're going to do, meaning we may or may not have a curative approach. We don't know if we want to do an allo. We don't know if we have donor availability. And in those patients, I'll usually start with pralatrexate or another agent that I could use in a continuous fashion. The idea being you start it, you see how you do. In the meantime, you're kind of looking into transplant options. If you get a good response and you feel okay, then you have the option of taking the risk of transplant with that possible benefit or just maintaining on these drugs because the median response duration, at least for pralatrexate, is 10 plus months. So you can kind of just see how long that goes if you don't want to take the step to transplant or while you're getting that organized. I use kind of the other single agents and mild sort of combinations the same way. Romidepsin, I imagine if the data from the phase 2 looks good and gets approved, I would use in the same fashion. And then if you have a good response and you want to do a transplant, you can step over to that. If you have a good response and you don't, you can maintain it. If you don't have a good response, then just move to the next one on the list. You know, in New York, where I work, it's often patients, it's hard for them to get into the city every week. So sometimes we'll try things they can get at home first before having to come in for a weekly regimen. And then we try to incorporate clinical trials into our practice too, because none of these are curative approaches.
How about your sort of general approach / algorithm to CTCL?
CTCL is complex, particularly for oncologists who often don't see the early stage patients, which are really the majority. So the early stage patients who have skin only or limited skin only are really probably best managed with skin-directed therapies or mild systemics, things like retinoids, like a bexarotene, sometimes interferon, sometimes vorinostat. A lot of times the oncologists, the general oncologists, I think those patients are treated by the dermatologist and they mostly see the advanced patients. So I think if you're an oncologist who only sees that occasionally and you come across an early stage patient, I mean, one thing that I think is important is to know most of those patients don't progress and they do okay with kind of skin-focused therapies. For the patients who need systemic therapy, so they've either progressed after skin-directed therapy or they have more advanced disease, I kind of take the approach, you know, what's the minimal therapy that could control their disease? Or because it's really always a maintenance approach, meaning even when we get remissions, they're almost never durable off of therapy. I think you can think like, well, if they're all going to work for 2 years, which one would I rather be on for 2 years? So usually that means I start with something oral and mild. And in my practice, it's usually bexarotene, which is a retinoid. Vorinostat is oral. I think once you get beyond bexarotene, which is probably the only one of the systemic agents that you might feel completely normal on, you know, it's possible you would have some high triglycerides, but if your thyroid's a place, you might feel normal day to day. I think after that, everything has some chance of systemic side effects. Vorinostat, interferon, romidepsin, other single agent chemotherapies. I think then once you're in that group, then you're saying, well, what's the least toxic next choice based on dose schedule, things like that, and then kind of move through.
How about pralatrexate?
We have just finished a CTCL study with pralatrexate. It was kind of an inverse phase one, or what we sort of call the dose optimization study. So we looked at taking the approved dose of 30, where there is some toxicity in aggressive lymphomas, and backing that down to see if we could find a dose and schedule with almost no toxicity and still activity. And what we found was that even if we go down to 10 milligrams, which is a really low dose, we still get occasional grade 2 mucositis, very little or no hematologic toxicity. So we didn't find a dose where there was zero toxicity. But at 15 milligrams, 3 out of 4 weeks or above, we have about a 50% response rate, which is, you know, again, this is a kind of a phase 1-2-ish study, and it's comparable to whatever else is out there. This is now about a 50-patient study. So I think lower doses for that disease, you can still get activity. And a lot of those patients at those low doses, you can maintain really with very little toxicity. And again, we do have a few people a couple years out on that therapy. So I think that is pretty good activity. We might need a bigger phase 2 experience because the dose has moved around to really confirm what that is. But if you look at bexarotene, vorinostat, romidepsin, denileukin, diftitox, liposomal doxorubicin, gemcitabine, 50% is a pretty high number for that disease.
About how many new cases a year are there in the United States of CTCL and peripheral T-cell?
I think probably the best sense we have is in mycosis fungoides CTCL, there's probably between 2,500 and 3,000 new cases a year. Again, 2/3 of those will probably be early stage. Because of all the molecular testing done on skin biopsies now, we might actually, I think, be overdiagnosing it a little bit. There's probably a little overcall. And then there's a much smaller number of the primary cutaneous CD30 positive lymphomas, cutaneous anaplastic large cell and lymphomatoid papulosis, probably 500 to 700, though I think those numbers are hard to come by. The aggressive peripheral T-cell lymphomas, it's probably about 10% of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, so about 6,000. I've seen estimates as high as 9,000. I think a lot of these patients have been coded, like in SEER data, as lymphoma not otherwise specified, but it's probably 6 to 9 in that number.
Let's talk about your cases. How about your 45-year-old man with peripheral T-cell?
Okay, so this case, you know, just as a jumping off point, a 45-year-old man, stage 4 peripheral T-cell lymphoma, not otherwise specified, high LDH, good performance status. This would be a guy who feels generally okay, may notice or would get some small lymphadenopathy in the neck. Primary doctor tried a course or two of antibiotics. That didn't improve. The lymph nodes grew. Not a lot of systemic symptoms, maybe a little bit of fatigue. Biopsy is done, comes back kind of surprisingly, you know, needle biopsy shows questionable lymphoma, though it's mostly T cells. In that case, it's very hard to exclude a reactive or a viral process. So goes back, has an excisional biopsy, looks like peripheral T cell lymphoma. We get a call, often we'll order the PET scan before we see the patient, see them, you know, lymph nodes above and below the diaphragm, but still feels generally well.
So what were the options you thought about and how was he treated?
The basic discussion and the thought is, are they curable? So you can look at the name of his disease, peripheral T-cell lymphoma, NOS, has a fairly low cure rate. Once you pick up any adverse risk factors like advanced stage, high LDH, then your chance of cure drops down quite a bit. So those are the people we look for towards more aggressive therapy. So probably the most commonly used treatment would be something like CHOP. We kind of know the results we get with that. We have phase 2 data that we think we do better with auto transplant. So my general approach in these patients has been, if they're young enough and healthy enough that we know we're going to do a first remission auto transplant, we'll start them on what we call accelerated CHOP. So that's an every 2 week CHOP with a little more Cytoxan. It's sort of a memorial version of CHOP.
Dose dense.
Yeah, dose dense and a gram of Cytoxan instead of 750 milligrams. Again, no comparative data say that's clearly better, but it's what we do. Repeat the scans after 4 cycles. Assuming that clinically, I think they're improving, and this guy was. And then if they're in remission, our plan is to take them to an upfront auto. So give 2 to 3 cycles of ICE, collect them after the last cycle of ICE, and then consolidate with an auto transplant. If they're not in remission after CHOP, that's when we'll start looking for donors, because a young guy with primary refractory disease, we've done very poorly with auto transplant at Memorial. Not all the data is like that, but our data shows that that's rarely curative. So then we'd start looking at an allo.
So what happened with this man?
So he tolerated the therapy well, had a good response to the CHOP, really no residual disease, got 3 cycles of ICE because I tend to lean towards a little more, and then consolidated with an auto transplant. And so far, recovered from that fine and is in remission, though it's probably 7-8 months from the end of therapy now. When we look at the relapse curves, like from the German upfront transplant data, the patients who got transplanted in first CR are over 70% alive at 3 years, but there is a kind of relapse rate over the first 2 to 3 years. So I then would follow this guy. We talk a lot about, is there post-transplant maintenance therapy to give? But right now, not that we know of, and we don't have a study.
Any thoughts about how you might treat him if he did develop a relapse?
Yeah, it kind of depends on when. So the people who relapse right after the auto, we kind of get into trouble on them because it's hard to give them second line therapy. They generally won't tolerate other aggressive therapy. If he were to relapse a year or more later, I think it's a similar discussion, a little bit to what we talked about before. Do we have a curative option? Do we want to think about an allotransplant and go right away to that in a donor? I don't remember right off the top of my head if this guy has siblings or not. Or are we in a non-curable setting, meaning do we think it's more palliative, in which case single agents, investigational drugs, or do we not know? And if we don't know whether we want to do the aggressive approach, do an allo, or just really try to treat with maintenance. In a young guy, we would generally push towards an allo, then pick one of those therapies that has a response rate, and then kind of sort out the allo process over the first couple of months. Do we have a donor? Is he healthy enough to get that? And then see where you go from there. If you have a great response to your second line therapy, you could use that to transition into allo. If you don't have a great response, but you have a donor, you could then intensify the therapy to a different combination regimen, and then try to get a remission and go to an allo. And then, you know, using investigational agents also, should we not be going directly to allo, you know, looking at new drug studies and such.
How about your 81-year-old woman with angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma?
Yeah, so I actually have, I don't know if it would make an interesting paper, I have this whole collection of women in their 80s with angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. It does often present in elderly, and I think this woman sort of typifies that group, which is you see someone with a bad disease, and if you look pretty critically at the data, the chance of being cured with something like CHOP for angioimmunoblastic, maybe 20% or so. But in an older woman who presents with advanced stage disease, you look at those high risk factors, high LDH, advanced stage, the cure rate is probably awfully close to zero. So this woman presented sort of like these people present, fevers, some rash, it comes on slowly. The primary doctor is looking for allergic things, looking at viral infections, courses of antibiotics. Someone empirically gives a course of prednisone because they think it's a reaction to something. Everything gets better. Then over a month or two, everything grows back, eventually gets a biopsy and shows angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. So if you can sort of establish that this person is of an age and of a health and of a state of disease, that the chance of curing with aggressive chemotherapy is probably really not there, often I'll take kind of an initial palliative approach. And what I do with most of my older patients with angioimmunoblastic is start them off with a pulse of prednisone. I'll give them something like 100 milligrams a day for 5 days. Almost everybody will respond to that, and then they kind of separate themselves out. There's a group that will have some durable response to that. 6+ months, it'll go away and take to grow back. And in those people, then when it comes back, I'll just do it again. This lady fell into the other category, which is probably a little more common, which they get better, but within 3 to 6 weeks, you already see the lymph nodes and some of the symptoms coming back. I personally don't like giving long-term continuous prednisone to elderly women because I think we get into trouble with that. There are some people who would just put them on prednisone and leave them on a long course. I usually think if you're only intermittently sensitive to prednisone, then we'll kind of move and look into something else. But really, the goal is palliative therapy. So my first choice and what I gave in this woman is sort of an oral palliative chemotherapy regimen that I call oral SEP. It's very similar to what people call PEP-C, where I'll start them off with low dose of oral Cytoxan and etoposide and prednisone. This is very empiric and the doses change, but usually I'll start them off at 50 flat of Cytoxan a day oral, 50 flat of etoposide a day oral, do that for 7 days every other week, usually just give 5 days of prednisone with that, and then see how they do. This woman responded very nicely to that, and then I'll usually switch them, which I did in her case, to a 10-day every 3-week regimen, and then kind of spread that out as time goes on. If you look at what happens with a lot of people with CHOP, with angioimmunoblastic, is they respond well to CHOP, but they almost always relapse within the first 3 to 6 months. So I think for the oral chemotherapy, I kind of assume the same, which is if we stop it, it's going to come back right away. So often what I'll do is I'll just spread out the cycles. I think this lady is on 7 days every 4 weeks now. I have a couple people on 7 days every 5 weeks. And you just kind of manage them long-term like that, as long as it works. And then when it stops working, move on to something else.
So how long has it been since you first started to treat her?
She is probably between 2 and 3 years out now on this regimen.
And what's her quality of life been like over that time?
Quite good. Never been in the hospital since we started therapy. Doesn't feel as well on the days of chemotherapy as the days off of chemotherapy. Based on how poorly they feel on the chemotherapy, though it's very low dose, sometimes we'll adjust the schedule or the doses a little bit. I find that often it's the prednisone are the days that they feel the worst. And once their disease is under control, we can back down on that to low doses, and I often do. And then if they really don't feel well on the chemotherapy, you just try to spread out the intervals. Again, the longest I have anyone on right now in these older patients with angioimmunoblastic is a week every 5 weeks, and just sort of try to use that for long-term control. If they're in remission for a year or so, I kind of talk to the patient. Sometimes my tendency is to try to stop and just see what happens. But mostly when we do that, you see disease starting to come back within a few months or so, and then we just put them back on it. But I think that's often a situation where, you know, if you use any of these kind of second line or palliative regimens, they can be used in continuous fashion to try to control disease. We have an experience with cyclosporin, which for this specific subtype, where some of these patients are maintained pretty well on cyclosporin long-term. Start them on an initially high dose of 300 milligrams twice a day and then taper them down. We published a paper, Ranjan Advani from Stanford is the first author on an experience of that with angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. And that's another sort of potentially well-tolerated approach.
How about your 62-year-old man with ALK-negative anaplastic large cell?
Yeah, so this is sort of the potential to what could happen to the guy in number one. A relatively young, healthy patient, meaning that he would be amenable for more intensive therapy. This patient I didn't see initially. He was initially treated on the outside, had ALK-negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma, stage 3 disease, presented primarily with nodal disease, and received 6 cycles of CHOP, had a complete response, and then was followed. And then what happens with some of these patients is that they relapse, and in the anaplastic large cell lymphoma, there's a lot of extranodal disease. So this guy relapsed about a year and a half after treatment with nodal disease and skin lesions, rebiopsied of both, showing that it's the same process. So then that's a similar question is, what do you do in that case? Is there a curative option? And this is a situation where I'm really not sure what to do. And I'll kind of talk you through that. When we've looked at our data of relapse patients with T-cell lymphoma, relapse or refractory patients. I looked retrospectively at a group of our patients who we treated with the intent to transplant. So if we look at only the patients who are transplanted, the results are not that bad. 30% or so of patients are long-term in remission, and it's not that much worse than we get with B-cell lymphoma. When we kind of looked at the patients from the time of relapse, not at the time of transplant, we're under 20%, about 17% of patients are long-term in remission. So I've kind of taken on the idea that auto-transplant at relapse is not very effective. The exception to that, I find, may be the patients with anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So those patients may do a little bit better. So while my general approach is not to transplant patients with the aggressive T-cell lymphomas, not do auto-transplants at relapse, I more favor allo if we're trying for a curative approach. I think in the anaplastic large cell patients who are healthy, who've had more than a year remission, I think that's a group where it's kind of an open question. So this guy actually is a case which exemplifies what I don't usually do, which is he got ICE at relapse, had a good response, and then moved on to auto transplant, and he's just short-term after that right now. I think a realistic view of that approach is probably when you're doing auto at relapse, you are at best delaying the relapse and probably not curing most of these people. And so the question becomes, you know, in a patient who could tolerate aggressive therapy, do you want to do the auto at relapse or do you want to think about allotransplant at that time? If you're taking a curative approach, you know, these cases don't exactly highlight that a lot of the patients, we really don't have a curative option. If you take the patients who are too old and don't have a donor, that makes up more than half of the patients with relapse disease.
Let's finish out chatting about another one of your interests, Hodgkin's disease.
Hodgkin's, yes. We have a couple of exciting new drugs in Hodgkin's. Probably the most soon and maybe most exciting one is the SGN-35, which is an anti-CD30 antibody conjugated to chemotherapy, a tubulin inhibitor, auristatin. And we had done some work with some of the other CD30 antibodies, and there's a couple of unlabeled CD30 antibodies that didn't have a lot of activity, except actually in some of the cutaneous CD30-positive lymphomas, but also had almost no toxicity, a few responses, a few stable disease patients. But the SGN-35 data in Hodgkin's is really quite good. There was a lot of responses, including complete responses in the phase one, and they just finished a phase two, has just finished enrolling. So I haven't seen response data on that yet, but based on the responses and some of the CRs in the phase one studies they looked at, the thought is that that drug may get approved for relapse refractory disease as a single agent, and they're launching a post-transplant consolidation/maintenance study for relapse patients with Hodgkin's, a randomized study, I think, to try to prove benefit. So that drug may be available soon. It looks like it has very good activity, both in Hodgkin's and in anaplastic large cell lymphoma. There's a couple of different schedules. There's a weekly regimen and there's an every 3-week regimen. And I actually don't know which one, well, if it would get approved, which regimen would go forward. So I think that drug's on the horizon. At Memorial, Craig Moskowitz and Allison Moskowitz, no relation to Craig, have a study of bendamustine for relapsed Hodgkin's, where they've also seen a very high response rate in those patients who've relapsed. So you get good responses. They have not seen a lot of durability. So the response rate's high, often complete responses, but then pretty quick relapses. So the thought is using that potentially as a bridge to another therapy like transplant of some sort. But at least that in a phase two looks like it has good responses. And then we saw data at ASCO on panobinostat, the HDAC inhibitor, given for relapsed Hodgkin's. I think it was all or almost all patients who had relapsed after auto transplant. And they had something like a 27-ish, 30% response rate in that setting with some durability. The data looked actually interesting, a lot like the pralatrexate data in T-cell lymphoma, which is kind of why I remember it. 27% response rate, 9 to 10-month progression-free survival. So that looked like a possibly active agent in that. You know, whenever you have these settings where you don't have good drug comparators, I don't know in relapsed refractory Hodgkin's whether 20% is really good. I don't think it's bad. You know, I think it's a reasonable response rate. So that may come before the FDA as well.
Any thought about that agent being looked at in studies up front?
We have a lot of interest in looking at early on in the CD30 positive T-cell lymphomas where we do kind of lousy with CHOP. I think with Hodgkin's, there is interest. The difficulty in Hodgkin's incorporating a new drug up front is you don't want to compromise the dose intensity of your upfront therapy if you're curing most people. So there's been some talk about trying to incorporate it into high-risk patients. I think if you're going to combine it in conjunction with chemotherapy, you probably have to do some phase one data first. You know, it's an antibody drug conjugate. It doesn't have a lot of myelosuppression. So I think the thought is it may not compromise delivery of chemotherapy, but it's not really known yet. In the T-cell lymphomas, we talked about doing things like maybe a window, you know, give it first and then follow or give it as consolidation. I think its role in consolidation is probably easier to define in an upfront setting.